Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and though it doesn't feel like it, happy spring, everybody. Spring is 3 hours and 4 minutes old, and it looks like both parties have new spring charm offenses going. Offensives. You heard about President Obama and Take a Republican to Lunch Week, but did you hear about the Republican Party's tough new self-analysis that came out this week, promising a new charm offensive to attract more young female and minority voters and show they take middle-class anxiety? Seriously, they've decided they can't just be the party of comfortable old white men if they want to have a future. But how? Well, Act One seems to be softening on gay marriage and comprehensive immigration reform. Here is Senator Rand Paul on the latter.
Immigration will not occur until conservative Republicans, like myself, become part of the solution. That's why I'm here today, to begin that conversation and to be part of the solution. I think the conversation needs to start by acknowledging that we aren't going to deport 12 million illegal immigrants.
Rand Paul speaking yesterday to the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and we actually edited the applause for time that was in the middle of that clip. They clapped longer, if not louder, than you heard. But immigration reform and gay rights may be the easy part. Economic policy may be harder to change. Do they need to do it? Raihan Salam is here to talk about it. He writes The Agenda, a policy blog at National Review Online. And in 2008, he was co-author with Ross Douthat of Grand New Party, How Conservatives Can Win the Middle Class and Save the American Dream. Hi, Raihan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
So the report calls for, well, first of all, why start with immigration reform? The old Republican position was that America, the U.S., can absorb the number of immigrants coming in illegally and that it's a rule of law issue, too. Amnesty today will draw in millions more illegally tomorrow. So do those positions just get abandoned in pursuit of Latino votes?
Well, there are a lot of issues here, one of which is that when you look at the undocumented population in the United States right now, a very large share of it has been here for a long period of time. And one implication of that is that you have many mixed-status families. That is, families in which the parents are undocumented, but the children might be U.S. citizens. So there are a lot of complex issues about what you actually do with the 11 to 12 million folks who are here right now. And I think that a lot of Republicans are facing up to that. Now, my own view is that saying that we need a full amnesty or path to citizenship is not really the business of the RNC to say. I think that's a larger policy debate, and I think that some folks like former Florida Governor Jeb Bush have tried to offer sensible middle way solutions. But I think that it is certainly something we need to think deeply about because, again, a lot of these families have been here long enough that no one realistically wants them to leave.
Is there going to be anything left to the Democrat versus Republican congressional debate on comprehensive immigration reform? Listening to an interview with Senator Paul yesterday, it almost sounded like it might shape up now as path to citizenship versus path to a green card, which I don't know if it's that meaningful in political terms, but is it going to be something like that?
Well, there are a lot of other debates that are going on in parallel, and it's not clear where Democrats and Republicans are going to wind up. In fact, I think you're going to see both parties divided in various ways. So, for example, right now our immigration policy is very skewed or very leaning towards family reunification. That accounts for a big, big chunk of the folks who enter the country legally every year. Now, that makes a lot of sense if you are, for example, a foreign-born citizen of the United States. You want family reunification because that benefits your own family, so you have a strong political interest in that. But there are other folks who say, wait a second, you know, America's immigration policy should be built around America's economic needs. So we want to attract larger numbers of skilled workers. So we want to skew our immigration policy, much as Canada and Australia and other countries do, towards skilled workers rather than relatives of current Americans.
I do want to open up the phones for Republicans right now, as this RNC report has been out for a couple of days. If you follow Republican-leaning media, you've seen a lot of conversation about it, and in the general press, too. So what do you think? Is it time for the party to be introspective? Is it time to change policy as well as just messaging? And on anything more than immigration reform or gay marriage, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9696. 972-647-1392. If you are a Republican or Republican-leaning person and want to get in on this conversation, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. So if immigration reform is big policy change number one to reach more Latinos in particular, is there a big policy change number two?
Well, in the Growth and Opportunity Project report, they make reference to Republican positions on civil rights issues and on outreach to gay Americans. And I think that when you're looking at that issue, they don't make explicit recommendations. But the chairman of the RNC, Reince Priebus, explicitly seemed to endorse the fact that Senator Rob Portman has opened up the debate on same-sex marriage among Republicans. Senator Portman is the most prominent by far current elected Republican office holder to endorse same-sex marriage rights in his state of Ohio. And I think that when you're looking at younger voters, and there was a new ABC poll on this subject, when you're looking at younger voters in general, and even younger Republican voters, there's much more support for same-sex marriage than there is among older voters. And so that's a real tension for Republicans because, again, within the Republican coalition, you have this majority group that opposes what a growing majority of Americans support. And so if you want to win swing voters, that could potentially be a tension.
And we've seen along generational lines, Andrew Breitbart, when he was live, hosted a big gay Republican party at CPAC, you know, and that was a couple of years ago before it was au courant as it is now. But this outreach to minorities is generally discussed as being about Latino voters. But I also want to get your take on Asian Americans. Asian Americans voted even more for Obama than Latinos did by a few points, 74%. And I think that was up 10 points from 2008. But Asian Americans, by many measures, could be natural Republicans or at least poised to be more evenly divided. Compared to white Americans as a group, they're more entrepreneurial, more inclined toward believing in personal responsibility. They feel less entitled. They do better in school, pretty traditional family-wise, becoming more Christian, and upwardly mobile, moving into Republican-leaning income ranges. And yet they voted 74% for Obama. What do you make of those election results?
Well, my view is that it actually isn't all that surprising for another separate reason, which is that Asian American voters tend to be concentrated in big metropolitan areas. And when you look at big metropolitan areas, they have shifted dramatically towards Democrats since the late 1980s. So, for example, if you're looking at very similar white Americans, upper middle income white Americans with college educations who live in the suburbs of cities like New York or Los Angeles or San Francisco, you'll see that they're also very likely to be Democratic, even when they have quite high incomes, even when they're entrepreneurial and what have you. So my take is that Asian Americans shouldn't be understood primarily along lines of ethnicity, but rather should be understood along the lines of their cultural affiliations. For example, you know, what kind of religion do you practice? And also along the fact that, you know, as people who are big city voters, they think the way that other big city voters do, which is why Republicans might want to think less about ethnicity and more about why they've lost so many of the voters in these big city suburbs.
So is there a way for them to go for big city suburbs rather than talking about it in terms of Latino votes or by class?
Yeah, I think there is. For example, when you look at Northern Virginia, you have the governor of Virginia, Bob McDonnell, who decided, look, we really need to tackle traffic congestion, and that might mean that we have to raise new tax revenues in areas like Northern Virginia, Hampton Roads, in order to fund new road construction. And the funny thing is that a lot of upper middle income voters in those areas say, you know what, traffic congestion is a huge part of my life. I would be willing to make some sacrifice there to get better results in terms of traffic congestion. Yet a lot of conservatives in Virginia were very resistant to this idea. Now, again, I don't think raising taxes is the only way to tackle traffic congestion. But if you're not talking about issues like traffic, issues like school quality, these quality of life issues, then you're not very relevant to voters living in big cities and suburbs.
All right, Republicans, call up and chime in on this if you want. 212-433-WNYC. And by the way, some Democrats have called in first to try to pounce on the Republicans' troubles. So let's hear from some of your Republican callers and tell us what you make of this moment. Is this introspection at a risk of, you know, diluting real Republican values that need to be maintained? Or what should change? 212-433 WNYC 433-9692. But let me give some voice to the critics on the left who've been saying things like, you want to reach more minorities? Stop trying to disenfranchise them with targeted voting limitations. Stop attacking protections for the poor that they disproportionately depend on. Minimum wage, worker rights, stop skewing the tax code toward the wealthy. Do you accept the idea that Republican values and interest groups are fundamentally at odds with what most Black and Latino Americans see as in their interest?
I think that there are definitely some tensions, partly because of the existing Republican constituency. Right now, the Republican Party represents disproportionately middle-income white voters. They tend not to represent voters in big cities and the suburbs of big cities, but rather in the suburbs of smaller cities. And so that gives them a very different profile. And that's something that the report actually addresses. The report addresses this idea that Republicans spend too much time talking to each other. And so that's one of the downsides of having a less diverse political party. And I think that having a more diverse political party would introduce the idea that, you know, low-income aspirational voters have certain concerns that Republican politicians ought to be more sensitive to. I disagree with the idea that Republicans don't care about economic uplift for poor and working-class people. But I do think that actually your policy mix is going to be narrower when you don't have those people in your constituency.
And I mentioned in introducing you your 2008 book, Grand New Party, which is about how the Republicans can appeal more to the middle class. Because I recall our interviews back then when you and Russ Douthat were already saying the GOP has a middle class problem. They can't just say tax cuts and prosperity will trickle down. That's not enough for today's middle class anxiety. So did they not get the message that you put out there for the last 5 years?
Well, we've been saying this stuff for at least 10 years, and I think that you now have more Republican politicians who recognize that there's a problem. Now, one issue is that when you look at the RNC report and when you look at a lot of the other Republican introspection moments that we're having, people are talking about moving to the center on social issues, but they're not necessarily talking about moving to the center on economic issues. And my own view is that moving to the center on a wide range of economic issues is actually a lot more important than moving to the center on social issues. Now, moving to the center can mean different things to different people, but the heart of it is the idea of being more relevant to middle-income and working-class voters who are struggling and who have a lot of anxiety about how they're going to make economic progress.
So what's a policy example of that?
Well, my own view is that one thing to build on is the child tax credit. Right now, when you're looking at a lot of middle-income families, it's actually a huge struggle for them to raise children because the opportunity cost of raising children is high when you have two earners in the workforce. So what are things you can do to mitigate that problem? Now, you know, one view that I have and a lot of other conservatives have is that when you're thinking about Republicans, they always talk about entrepreneurs and how entrepreneurs take risks to invest in the future. But so do parents. So in a way, we ought to take the money that parents spend to raise their children well, to see to it that they have skills, as an investment in America's future human capital. So that is one thing we ought to consider, raising taxes on people like me who are childless and who earn a pretty decent income and lowering them on people who have children, particularly the more children you might have. And that's going to apply to a lot of Asian Americans and Latinos. That's going to apply to a lot of middle class folks living in the suburbs of big cities. But you need to rebalance that tax burden.
Is that relevant to what we're actually going to be talking about in our next segment, which looks at the emerging New York State budget that they're passing or debating and finalizing in Albany right now, where there is literally an extension of the so-called millionaire's tax, which was supposed to expire, but people making $1 million a year or couples making $2 million a year will continue to pay a higher tax rate. And there's going to be a tax credit for couples or any parents earning up to $300,000 or so, specifically based on their parental status.
Well, I think that that's actually not the ideal way to do it for this reason. I think when you're looking at the United States as a whole, Democrats and Republicans have been trying to shield upper middle income households for tax increases. And the truth is that I think that if you're shielding upper middle income households from tax increases, you're not going to get the revenue that you need to write the ship, particularly if you're going to actually offer better tax treatment to truly middle-income households with children. So I think that in New York State, the problem is that when you're looking at those couples making, say, between $200,000 and $300,000 a year, they're very politically influential. But unless you're taxing those guys as well as millionaires, you're not necessarily going to get to a real viable budget settlement.
Reihan Salam with us from National Review, their agenda policy blog, reacting to the scathing report by the GOP about itself after the 2012 elections, 212-433-WNYC. And here's an alienated, disillusioned Republican, I think, John in Oradell. Hi, John, you're on the air. John, you there? Let's see if we can find John somewhere here among the switches and the wires. John, you there? We're going to try one more time. All right, let's go to Anwar in Queens. Anwar, hello.
Yes, hi, hello.
Hi. You're on the air,
hello.
Anwar. Go ahead.
Anwar?
Yes. Yes, you.
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me? Oh, my goodness. Okay. Oh.
I can hear them.
Go ahead. Go ahead. If you can hear me, go ahead.
Hi. Hello?
Yeah, all right. So obviously we're having some telephone troubles. One thing in the report that had to do with business said that the Republican Party should, quote, speak out against business. And, of course, it's referring to certain circumstances. So, for example, quote, we should speak out when a company liquidates itself and its executives receive bonuses, but rank-and-file workers are left unemployed. We should speak out when CEOs receive tens of millions of dollars in retirement packages, but middle-class workers have not had a meaningful raise in years. What do you make of that passage?
Well, I think that if it's married to sound ideas about the economy, then I think it can make a lot of sense. For example, right now we have a tax code that is very strongly biased towards firms that can borrow, that can raise large amounts of debt. And the thing is that the firms that can raise large amounts of debt are big incumbent companies that have existed for a long time that have a track record, as opposed to startups. So if we change the debt bias and the tax code, we might actually create a situation in which more of these big, large incumbent firms face a more competitive environment. And if they face a more competitive environment, well, guess what? They wouldn't be sitting on huge hoards of cash. They might find themselves forced to raise compensation for their workers. We might have a much healthier economy overall. So my view is that you need to emphasize the fact that a more competitive economy, in terms of more competitive for those big, large incumbent firms that find ways to game the tax system, would actually be better for employers as well as for innovation and growth.
Do the various things that you've said in the last few minutes mean you think that the Republicans in Congress should go for some kind of grand bargain that Obama and the Democrats want them to go for, where they close a lot of tax loopholes, do allow high enough rates that, you know, revenues will rise by closing those loopholes and deductions, and trying to solve the deficit problem about 50% that way?
No, I think that would be a mistake. My view is that when you look at the top tax rates right now, the 39.6% rate that we had during the Clinton era, I think we just shouldn't fight on lowering that rate substantially. Rather, if you're going to raise money by closing loopholes, we should talk about more middle-class tax relief for parents with children. That's the way to think about it. Right now, if you look at Senator Patty Murray's budget proposal, her idea is close loopholes, but then use those the closing of those loopholes to finance the expansion of various government programs. Now, it could be that you can have some settlement in which some revenue is used for deficit reduction, but I think that it's very important to highlight the importance of middle-class tax relief. In 2012, you had a Republican presidential candidate who didn't really talk about middle-class tax relief, particularly because most middle-class households pay more payroll tax than income tax. And I think that was a very big mistake for Republicans.
Patty Murray, by the way, I think would characterize how she would use the money as trying to stave off a crippling reform to Medicare or Social Security rather than a more affordable, sensible reform, rather than trying to expand government programs, no?
Well, actually, all of these programs are growing over time. And the question is, what is the rate at which they're likely to grow? Now, I think that, you know, one might agree that the cuts that Paul Ryan has for Medicaid are unrealistically large. You can come somewhere in between the current trajectory and where he plans to go. But I think that she doesn't actually acknowledge that the growth of Medicaid spending is so great that you need to do something, particularly to incentivize states to pursue more rational, sensible policies.
Before you go, let me get your take on two leading Republicans in the context of this self-critical report. One, Paul Ryan, the opposite number of Patty Murray, obviously, with his budget. And in the context of the party's self-critique, do you think his policies of Medicare as a fixed voucher, proposal to repeal Obamacare, abandon food stamps and Medicaids as federal entitlements, are the big new report and the big new budget working across purposes?
Well, two things. One is that I would characterize the Ryan budget very differently from the way that you've characterized it just now. For example, with regard to food stamps, what he's talking about is shifting it to a block grant program so that states have more flexibility. Now, again, I might disagree with him regarding his planned reductions in spending, but I think that the general principle of giving states more discretion is not a bad one. But separately, well, yeah, that's arguably a problem that the report is talking more about moving the party to the center on social issues rather than talking about a new message on economic issues. And one concern that I have is that congressional Republicans are emphasizing the goal of balancing the budget in 10 years so much that it's at the expense of crafting a broader, more inclusive, more forward-looking and positive economic message.
And about Rand Paul, I guess he is not his father's libertarian as he works to raise his profile for a possible presidential run. We know about the filibuster against drone strikes on U.S. soil against Americans with no due process. But then he also introduced a fetal personhood bill the other day. Older libertarians used to be pro-choice based on their belief in limited government. He says he's for public schools. I heard him say that in an interview yesterday. And now he's for this path to permanent residency, but with securing the border first, including, he said, drones, by the way, surveillance drones. I think his father is more of a straightforward, open borders libertarian. How do you see Rand Paul being his father's son, but not trying to be written off as on the libertarian fringe?
Well, actually, I disagree with you. Ron Paul was part of a wing of the libertarian movement that oftentimes did advocate immigration restriction and was very staunchly pro-life. When Ron Paul was the libertarian presidential nominee in 1988, he fought against a guy called Russell Means, who was a more traditional, socially liberal libertarian, as you describe. So the libertarian movement in this country is very diverse, and Rand Paul comes more from that Ron Paul strand. But it is true that Rand Paul has tried to soften his father's message in many, many ways. And I think that in a way, he can be seen as an heir to this long march through the institutions. Ron Paul in 1988, you know, was totally marginal. He ran in 2008. He was more influential. 2012, more influential still. And I think Rand Paul is trying to complete that process by bringing him into the mainstream.
Raihan Salam writes The Agenda, policy blog at National Review Online. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will explain that emerging New York State budget, including the tax extensions for some, tax credits for others, and other details. Stay with us.